welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham. And with me on this episode, we have a woman who is an actress. She's a singer. She's a storyteller. And her name is Anne Tallman. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Anne is here because coming up on February 28th, she will be at the Arts Club of Washington in Washington, D.C., doing her show called Elizabeth Taylor, The Shadow of Her Smile, which she has a very interesting history with Elizabeth Taylor. And yes, I mean that Elizabeth Taylor. double Oscar winning famous Elizabeth Taylor movie star. But we will delve into that a little bit as well. We also want to highlight a couple of other dates you have coming up. You are going to be in New Jersey at the Barrymore Film Center on May 8th. And then if people are planning ahead, they will see you at the Tennessee Williams Festival in New Orleans in March of 2027. But all of that is included on your website, which we will have a link for your website here on the radio show page, as well as a link for the event on February 28th, so people can purchase tickets to see you and this terrific show where she talks about her kind of life experience and long-lasting friendship, working relationship and friendship with Elizabeth Taylor that went on for many years. Anne's credits, I should say, her Broadway credits include not only The Little Foxes, which is where she met Elizabeth Taylor and was Anne's Broadway debut and Elizabeth Taylor's Broadway debut, but Anne also appeared in House of Blue Leaves and Some Americans Abroad and the revival of The Women, which I saw on Broadway. Yes, I saw that production. She also has many off-Broadway TV and film credits. So let's begin the journey with the talking about kind of what your journey was into performing. Because I know from, I've listened to the audio of your entire show, so I know kind of what the show was about. But I know from the show that you loved performing as a child for your family, right? So talk a little bit about how that all led to you kind of getting into performing altogether.
I think from the moment I popped out, my parents knew, oh boy, she's going to be an actress. And I always sang. I mean, I started out in nursery school, kindergarten, church choir, and everything. One of my favorite stories is in kindergarten, practically on the first day of kindergarten, the teacher, Mrs. Baumgartner, announced that there would be a Christmas pageant and someone was going to sing Silent Night. And that, you know, closer we would, there'd be a sing-off. Well, I went home that day, walked in the door, said, Mom, I'm going to sing the solo in the pageant at Christmas. We have to practice. So every day we would practice singing Silent Night in the basement at the upright piano. And sure enough, I won the sing off and sang it. And I always was singing and being goofy, and I was a mimic, and I would do voices, and my parents, my mother was from Alabama, my dad was from Virginia, and I grew up in Pittsburgh, and those were three distinct accents, and I would mimic them all, but I made up my mind I didn't want one, so I basically taught myself standard English, but, and the other interesting aspect is that I had an older brother named Woody who was brilliant and gorgeous, but severely cerebral palsied from birth. He was a nonverbal, spastic quadriplegic. And I sort of was his translator throughout life. And I think it just kind of enhanced me as an actress, And my parents just would all, I had an imaginary tiger that only I could see, and my parents would be like, oh, she's such an actress.
Well, you know, it's one thing to be, you know, like you said, a mimic and, you know, acting out and stuff with your family, but pursuing it as a career is like a totally different thing. So what got you on the path to decide to do performing and acting as a career?
Well, I was always in choir, and then in high school, I was in the musical every year, and I went to Penn State, and after 2 years, I realized, oh, my major's theater, because every semester, no matter what my major really is, I'm either in a play or a musical. That's my major. Mm-hmm. And then I auditioned for Carnegie Mellon after 2 years at Penn State, and I was accepted at the audition on the spot for the music department to be a voice major. And then I was waitlisted for theater and musical theater, which was a new program that Mel Shapiro was starting. But they wouldn't take any of my credits, and I was going to have to start over in a four-year program. And I just decided to stay at Penn State and become a theater major with a minor in music. And a week after I graduated, I moved to New York. Uh-huh. Lock, Stock, and Barrel, had never been there. My dad drove me. I got a New York phone book and found the Allerton House for Women to live at, which was the Bloomingdale saleswomen who were unmarried lived there.
Oh.
And no men allowed past the lobby. So my dad unloaded me and I was like, okay, bye. You know, and I was like Ruby Keeler, you know, in Dames at Sea. He had said, well, what about the Barbizon? And I said, no, that's too Ruby Keeler. I want something different. So I lived at the Allerton House for Women and I just started pounding the pavement. The very next day after I moved to New York, I went to Sardi's and put my name on the wait list for the coveted coat check job.
Because
I knew that would be a way to meet people.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh. And I signed up to join the union to be a Broadway usher.
Very smart. Very smart.
And my little bit self-serving anecdote is by the time my name came up to be a Broadway usher, I was on Broadway.
You're already on Broadway. Right, exactly. But it's a great job because you get to see so much theater and you get to meet a lot of interesting people that way.
Oh, and they're the best.
Yeah. It's a great, the ushers and the box office people who work in Broadway are a totally different group of people.
And the ushers at Lincoln Center, because I did two plays at Lincoln Center that started in the new house and then moved to the Beaumont. My brother came to all every show I ever did. My dad would bring my brother. Those ushers doted over my brother. Oh my gosh. You know, so.
So talk about, the fateful, fateful crossing paths with Austin Pendleton, who a lot of people will remember him as an actor. It did a lot of movies that people remember, but he was also a wonderful director, amazing director. So talk about that.
And a cabaret singer, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the after I swung by Sardi's on my second full day in New York City, I went to Top of the Sixes restaurant on Fifth Avenue and got the job on the spot to be the lunch hostess. And I met a wonderful guy named Larry Fetcho, who his best friend was Michael O'Flaherty, the extraordinary musical director who then went on to be the musical director at the Goodspeed for decades. And Michael was the cabaret. He was in charge of the Williamstown Theater Festival cabarets. And he became my vocal coach all that year. And he hired me to be the cabaret intern for the summer of 1980, along with Michael Starobin, who was a cabaret intern, the amazing orchestrator, and Brett Goldstein, who is now a manager. And I was the cabaret intern. I sang in all the cabarets, and that's how I met Austin Pendleton. I sang with him, and we just adored each other all that summer. That fall, I started studying with him at HB Studios, and when he got the job to direct, it was his Broadway debut too, to direct The Little Foxes, he asked me to audition. And I had like callback. Then I had to go to Lillian Hellman's apartment on Park Avenue and read for her twice.
I know, when I heard that in the show, I was a little dumbfounded because it's just, I mean, okay. So at that point, were you familiar with Little Foxes when it came out?
And of course, once I got the auditions, I studied like crazy. And Lillian had final casting say.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And she was almost legally blind. Her sight was so impaired. She was listening more than anything. So I didn't meet Elizabeth until the first day of rehearsal.
Right. And did you know that this was kind of being cast around Elizabeth Taylor? Did you know that right from the beginning?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay.
I knew that was why. Well, the other part of it that's just amazing, talk about destiny. Around the age of 3 or 4, I was imitating the percolator one day. And my mother looked at me and said, in her Southern accent, "Oh my goodness, you look like a young Elizabeth Taylor from National Velvet. You could almost play her daughter, even as a percolator." And from then on, whenever National Velvet was on TV, throughout my life, through and including when I got cast, if that movie was on, the next day, strangers would come up to me and say, "Oh, did anyone ever tell you you look like a young Elizabeth Taylor from National Velvet?" And she was 12, you know, so. And all through college, at Williamstown, and then even Barry Moss and Julie Hughes were the casting directors. And from day one, they were like, "Annie, you look like a young Elizabeth Taylor." And I'm like, "Well, thank you." And then the moment I met Elizabeth, it's in my show, but she gave me a huge hug, kissed my cheek, and then she whispered in my ear, "Oh my God, I feel like I'm looking at myself from National Velvet." And I said, "Why, thank you. I never heard that before." I didn't know what else to say. And so it was really just an amazing destiny come true.
And I think you also mentioned in the show, I don't want to give too much away for the show.
Oh, it's okay.
I know we want people to see it, but your mother had passed away right around the same time that you were cast, right?
Yeah. She was killed instantly in a car crash. Somehow Elizabeth sensed that I was motherless. And she instantly took me under her wing as a mother figure. And my dear friend, Kate Burton, who I met at Williamstown the summer of 1980, because she was she was what they called a GA, but it was like one rung up from intern. And we have been dear friends ever since. And she also would say to me from day one that her father married Elizabeth, Elizabeth embraced her as a daughter. And so she was very motherly and loving. And it remained so till her death.
Right.
We were very close. And I'm so grateful for that. Oh, yeah.
And you talk a little bit, we won't go too deep, but I know you talk a lot about in the show about some of the stuff that, first off, that what a prankster she was backstage, but people don't realize, but also how generous she was. With everyone, especially with you, and how much advice she gave you in so many different areas about how you dressed and how to deal with men. And so talk a little bit about that, because she also talked about, I mean, you also talk about all of her marriages and kind of marriage advice that she would give you and things like that. So talk a little bit about the friendship and how she kind of played the mother role and some of the advice she gave you and some of those stories?
She pretty early on could sense that I didn't have a real good fashion sense. Pretty early on, she would say, "Annie, no more sports bras. Lift and separate. Embrace your bosom." And I would be like, "No, I was like embarrassed." She would be like, "No, no, you must celebrate your décolletage." You know, so she was helping me become more womanly, become sexier. She would help me with makeup, and she did all her own makeup for every movie she ever did, everything for every, you know, Little Foxes. She knew what she was doing. She would help me with makeup. She would help me dress. And one of the examples was I did I met Andy Warhol, who was from Pittsburgh, where I grew up. And he did a photo shoot and put me in Interview magazine. And the gown I wore was a Bill Blass original. And Elizabeth wanted to give it to me. And I was too embarrassed that I thought I'd never wear it again. And, you know, I could just shoot myself now. And she just wouldn't give up. So she gave me an antique lace gown for my birthday subsequently. And when I wore it, my picture was in Women's Wear Daily the next day. So she just was wonderful to me like that. And she could tell that I was like awkward and gawky and needed help. And she would often offer to loan me her jewelry. And I would say, "No, I don't have enough insurance. What if I get kidnapped?" But she was very generous. Every single opening in every tour that we did, because we started in Fort Lauderdale, then we were at the Kennedy Center, then Broadway, then New Orleans, Los Angeles, and London. She would give everyone opening night gifts from Tiffany's.
Oh, my God.
And by everyone, I mean crew. Past the lighting, you know, stage managers, just everyone. She was so gracious, and she set the tone for how to be a leader,
which is it's so important in the theater to do that.
Yeah,
to have, especially when you have a star name above the title, that people forget that they set the whole tone for the production in terms of the cast. And it's hard, especially hard for her because she was making her Broadway debut. She had never done Broadway before.
We joined Actors Equity together, she and I. And like when we flew to LA to open there, we were all on the same plane and they were going to put her in first class and all of us in coach. And she said, "Oh, no, 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 no. Either everyone is in first class with me or I'll go in coach with them."
That's the team. That's a team leader. That's amazing. Talk about, because she also gave you later on, she gave you marital advice.
Yeah.
I mean, based on her many, many marriages.
Well, yeah. She, my first husband was the wonderful character actor, Bruce McVitie, who passed away in 2022. But she got to see me fall in love with him. And, you know, that was playing out the summer of 1981 while we were on Broadway. And she would say, "Oh, Annie, Bruce reminds me of a young Marlon Brando, and I should know, you know. So she was very encouraging of my romance with Bruce. But when we were in London, and I wasn't married yet, so when we were in London, I fell in love with a brilliant musician, musical theater actor named Martin Smith. Who was playing Che in Evita at the time. And he was gay, but bisexual, because we fell in love and had a romance. And he wanted to marry me. And Elizabeth said, Annie, don't do it. And she told me about how Montgomery Clift had wanted to marry her. He fell in love with her on A Place in the Sun. And she said, Annie, it will never work. It's funny, I fall right into being her. She said, be friends for life. Martin is your Monty. And it was hard for me because we loved each other, but I didn't marry him. And we were friends instead for life. Sadly, Martin died of AIDS in 1994. And I have a section in the show that's totally devoted to, I call it the AIDS section, her AIDS activism. She was the first person to stand up, and she co-created AMFAR with Dr. Kim and Dr. Krim, excuse me. And so that story fit into the AIDS section, but I really cherished her advice about that, you know. And I'm one of the few people that she ever shared all that about Montgomery.
Right.
And one time we would have slumber parties, and by the time we were in London, she had a townhouse and I would spend weekends with her, and we'd have slumber parties and watch old movies and eat popcorn and drink Suave Bola. And one night, I just said, Elizabeth, why do you keep getting married? You know, we were tipsy. And she said, because I love being married. And she proceeded to explain to me that when she was in love with someone, she wanted to be married. And her hairdresser, who was also living in the townhouse, one time he said to her, you know, Elizabeth, you don't have to marry everyone you sleep with. And she said, I am a lady.
That's too funny.
So, you know, so I have a whole section in the show that I call the hubby section. And it just has moments of songs and patter about each of her husbands. She loved each one at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't frivolous. She wasn't a frivolous person.
No. And, you know, but she had the means and the kind of a life to where she was married seven times, twice to the same person. So, you know.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. and I'm glad you brought up the AIDS situation, because you're right. She was so instrumental in putting a kind of public face on it, and really getting out there and taking a stand with Rock Hudson, and making it okay to talk about, and making it something to draw people's attention to. She was the first real celebrity out there to get out front of this and really make it a cause.
Absolutely. And what's extraordinary for me is that while we were in London in 1982, people were just beginning to say, hey, have you heard about that gay cancer out in San Francisco? I mean, that's what I remember. Fleetingly, someone would say something about it, and we would be like, oh, huh, no, I haven't heard about that, or whatever. And Tim Scott, who was cast in the American production of Cats, was around a lot, because I studied voice with Ian Adam, who was the West End voice teacher to the stars, and he was often around, and he had just gotten cast for Cats Coming to America. And he was one of the first people I knew who passed away from AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, within a year, it was affecting our lives.
Right, right.
And then in 85, she co-created AMFAR. And then in 1991, she founded the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation.
Which is a lasting legacy.
Yeah, and she put in her succession planning that her grandchildren would run it, and they do.
Everybody always thinks of her as the from the tabloids and the gossip columns and the marriages and the divorces and the tumultuous relationship with Burton, but they don't remember the side of her that was so caring and loving for her friends and the people around her. And that's really the most important thing, I think, is the legacy that she left behind.
And people have come away from my show. The biggest compliment I get is that I humanize her. People leave they've gotten to know the human Elizabeth Taylor, and that would have made her happy.
Right.
For sure. And it's funny because in the AIDS section of my show, I talk about how they did That's What Friends Are For, how it became the anthem. And I don't actually sing the song. I just sing the very last line of the song.
Uh-huh.
And reviews have said, my rendition of That's What Friends Are For. It's so beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And because she was very, very close to Carol Bayer Sager and Burt Bacharach. They were practically next door neighbors. So when they recorded that, Elizabeth was in the studio.
Right.
And they decided, hey, we're going to give all the proceeds to AMFAR.
Right, exactly. And so talk about, and I also note, it's interesting that when she did pass away, you received sympathy calls from people.
Because
she was your mother.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And it's like, like my mother passed away all over again, you know, Elizabeth was always late and having been the prankster that you mentioned, she arranged it so that her casket would arrive 10 minutes late to her own funeral.
Yes. So let's shift gears a little bit. And I want to talk about, now that we've talked about your kind of long, long-lasting friendship with Elizabeth Taylor, talk about the decision you made to kind of translate that into a one-woman show. And, you know, what you were hoping to convey to audiences that they didn't already know. So when did you make the decision to say, okay, I'm going to do this, and I want to do this as a one-person show to kind of get this out there?
It's kind of in sections because as I look back, even in 1981, as I was living the experience, I did my first cabaret at Paulson's with Cheryl Hartwick was my musical director. She was the pianist on Saturday Night Live. And I did a cabaret at Paulson's, and Elizabeth came twice. While I was doing the show, I remember thinking, someday I'm going to do a cabaret about this. And I know that I will sing Long Before I Knew You about meeting someone that I was told all my life about, you know. And so that song from 1981 was in the show. With Martin, I did a cabaret in London. Then I didn't do cabaret again until I was the primary caregiver for my brother when my mother died, and then my father got Alzheimer's. When he passed away finally in 2018, he was almost 70, my brother. I took a break because I was exhausted.
Yeah.
And then that fall of 2018, I created my own self-study grad school program, and my major was cabaret. And I could finally, for the first time, really do something that was just for and about me. And I just immersed myself in the world of cabaret. And I knew even then that my show was going to be the show about having been Elizabeth's daughter. And I pretty quickly called it The Shadow of Her Smile, because I wanted to sing that, The Shadow of Your Smile.
Mm-hmm.
And almost immediately, I reached out to Lena Katrakis, and she and I worked on it for a year before I even then reached out to Alex Rybeck.
Mm-hmm.
And then when COVID hit, I just kind of upped my game and worked on it intensely through COVID, and then we debuted March 2022. But also, when I lived in LA, I did a guest spot on Seinfeld, and I met Michael Richards, Kramer, and we fell in love, and we were a couple for 3 years, and we're still good friends. And while I was living that, and it ended, but we were friends, I remembered thinking, okay, they can't take that away from me, is the story of my romance with Michael Richards. And someday that's going to go in. Because also it tied in with Elizabeth, because the first time I went to the Emmys, I called Elizabeth and I said, what do I wear? What do I do? And she set up a fitting for me and just helped me through that. Thank you. would happen, and I would store them away or write them down to go into this show. And then the other thing was, I took a course on creating your own solo show, and I created a solo show, and then I actually made a documentary about it that premiered at Tribeca. It's all about my brother. But then I did one with the same teacher, just about Elizabeth and me. And I called it Who's Afraid of Elizabeth Taylor? It was a 20-minute piece because I wanted to dig very deeply into the mother-daughter relationship, the complexity of my mother having passed away, and my mother and I were not close. She had profound clinical depression the entire 20 years that I knew her. She was very sick. And I wanted to dig into that to prepare for the cabaret.
Right.
So that was all a part of it. So it was just, can I say, decades?
Well, it's, you know, these things have a very long gestation period.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's, as you said, it's little bits and pieces of your life that you kind of file away in the back of your head, or sometimes in literally file away in a file cabinet. But you do file them away until it's time, until the right moment comes along that it's time to put all those little pieces together and see what you've got. And this is what you've got.
And another song that I filed away since high school was Mira from Carnival, because it mentions, I come from the town of Mira, beyond the bridges of St. Clair. And I grew up in Upper St. Clair in Pittsburgh. And those lyrics always resonated with me. And I knew that I would sing that song one day about having, you know, and I then also got to play Lily in Carnival at the Goodspeed in 1986. And so that was another song I filed away that is in this show.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what your process was for selecting the songs, because there's some songs obviously make sense in terms of putting them in. But did you sit? Was it mostly you, or did you work, or did you collaborate on the songs with Alex Rybak? Was it mostly just you kind of pulling things along of bits and pieces you collected over the years?
It was predominantly me. I could actually even go through the song list and say that was me, that was me, that was me. Lena first, working with Lena, suggested Ship in a Bottle, which is probably one of my favorite songs to sing in the show. So that was Lena. And then ultimately when Alex came along, he had, you know, ideas and thoughts, mostly about the arrangements. I can't remember a specific song off the top of my head that Alex suggested, but Once in a Lifetime was always, you know, about the moment I got cast was how I felt, and I knew that was going to go in. And then there were a few that I had to fight for, because I remember at the end, Make Someone Happy. Lena and Alex didn't think it fit, and I was like, just trust me, it's going to work.
Thank you.
because I'm very lyric driven. To me, it's all about lyric first. And so every single word of every lyric in my show means something. And the other thing means something to me. But the other thing that I try to always stay on task with was it had to move the story forward.
Right.
And it had to relate to Elizabeth.
Uh-huh.
Even if it seemed like a tangent, it had to come back. And then you realize, oh, that's why she even mentioned that, because it really was about Elizabeth in some way. You know, my romance with Kramer was about Elizabeth because she got me through the Emmys. And that, I think, is always important in a play or a musical, is you have to keep going forward. I made sure that I never sang a song that I had just said what it was about, and then you sing the song, because that's redundant, you know?
Right, right, exactly, exactly.
Yep. And now I'm going to sing a song about blah, 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 and then you sing the song.
Yeah, yeah. It has to be, it has to feel like it naturally comes out of the moment and not be set up.
Exactly. And then the other thing that I always knew was me and that would work, but it took a while to get Lena and Alex used to it, is that I have this technique of incorporating patter within a song. And I don't know very many people who do it. And at first they'd never worked with that before, you know, because it really is, it's like a theater piece in a sense.
It is definitely like a theater piece. Yeah.
And I won the Bistro for Outstanding Musical Memoir. And so I'll have patter, then I'll just almost sneak into a song, and then I'll have a little bit more patter, and then more of the song, and then, you know, and once they got used to it, we flew with it. And that was fun, because also Lena had never really directed a show like mine. In that's more of a theater piece. And I'm telling you, she is just brilliant. She has such a theatrical sensibility. She has then gone on to direct Elvira Tortora in a wonderful piece called The Bookmaker's Daughter. Same, it's the same now genre that I feel like, you know, I got Lena comfortable with of a theater piece.
Right, exactly. And that kind of brings me to a point I wanted to discuss with you, which is, without giving too much away to anyone who hasn't seen the show yet, I wanted to talk to you about the acting challenges of bringing Elizabeth to life in the context of a piece of theater like this. Because it's one thing to simply get up on stage and tell funny, charming, sentimental stories about a famous movie star that you were friends with, but that's not really what happens with this show, which you can tell just by listening to the audio of it, because in reality, you really bring her to life on stage. It's almost like she's there on stage with you. So it's a totally different feeling, as opposed to just standing up there telling stories. So, and, talk about that.
That stems from, as I'd say, within a few weeks of being around Elizabeth and getting to know her, I started to do her, like, you know, for her, and she loved it. She had a famous cackle that I would do. She would just kind of like go, you know, and if you ever watch on YouTube her speech at the 1981 Tonys, where she does the Niedelheimer flub, she does the cackle and the whole thing. I used to do her doing that for her after that aired and everything. So almost from the get-go, I used to mimic her. I did it for Lena, and Lena was like, oh my gosh, if I close my eyes, I could swear you're her. And I was like, oh good, because, you know, I'm a mimic, that's what I do. And I just have huge chunks in the show where I just slip into being her saying what she says to me or whatever. And she had physical mannerisms that I would joke her with her about. I mean, she's only five. She was only 5 foot two, which is amazing. And so that just was always a part of the show. Katie Burton came to see it, like, I think my second performance. And she said, "Annie, I don't know why I wore makeup, because from the moment you opened your mouth, I was weeping." And I didn't stop until you did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she just said, "You," she even said, "I closed my eyes and she was here." Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Well, it's what makes it such a unique piece of theater. And in a way, it's, and I know that you said, you know, you wanted all the songs and everything to all loop back to Elizabeth. But in reality, the show is just as much about you as it is about Elizabeth. Because it is, even though you are telling a lot of stories about Elizabeth Taylor, you are the co-star in this. And it's also just as revealing about you as at the various stages of your life. So, you know, I want people to realize that as well. It's not like you're just standing up there talking about Elizabeth Taylor. It's very revealing about yourself.
Thank you. Yeah. And that, I think, was really, I got a lot of help getting that right from having done the Who's Afraid of Elizabeth Taylor 20-minute piece, because I dug deep into that stuff, and it's hard and it hurts. And there would be times in rehearsal where I would say, "Lena, is this just too much? Is it too deep? Is it too?" And she'd say, "Don't worry, I'll tell you if it's
right."
If, you know, and for instance, the first time I did the show, I mentioned that my mother was killed in a car crash. Didn't need to. We cut that, but you learn by doing. All that matters was she passed away close to when I got the part. I didn't need to. And so that was a time where she said, "Well, let's cut that and let's just, you know."
Mm-hmm. It's a very unique theatrical piece because you are really the one person who can perform this piece.
Well, Sidney Meier says that.
It's unique to you.
Sidney has now seen it 7 times. God bless Sidney. And he just goes, "Annie, no one can do this but you." And, you know, it's true. And like the whole section where I talk about the pranks that she played on stage, nobody knows about those things but me. Mm-hmm. Not even like Austin knows about some of those, because, you know, Elizabeth was, she was something else. And it's true. There's parts of it that I look back and I realize, wow. and actually, you know, I'm a writer, and I've just finished my nonfiction narrative memoir called Woody's Order about my brother Woody. Mm-hmm. But my next book is going to be the book of The Shadow of Her Smile. I'm going to take the manuscript of the cabaret and turn it into a book.
That's great.
Because everybody that I've mentioned it to was like, "Oh my gosh, that sounds readable."
Yes. Well, and you did mention, you mentioned a little bit ago that people have been telling you after the show that you've really humanized her on stage. What else do you hope audiences walk away with after seeing the show?
Well, the part that's about me, the battles that I've had in my life, I hope they walk away knowing never give up. And because there's a section where I talk about how one of my former agents said to me, "You know, honey, when you get to be your age and you're not a star, people wonder what's wrong with you." And I said, "I'm 30. And I have to take care of my father and brother no matter what. So it has created gaps in my career." And he goes, "I know, but no one cares." And boom, that's true. However, I'm resilient and I don't give up. And it's never too late to keep reinventing yourself.
Right.
And, you know, I belong back on Broadway. It's about time I'm back on Broadway. You know, I want to get another Broadway show. I want to do some more TV. I want to do this. I want to do that. And just don't give up.
Right.
And I address that I have battled. Well, I've had an eating disorder that is totally under control. But and I found that I was medicating with alcohol. So I woke up one day 22 years ago and I just said, I'm never going to have another drink. Don't need it. It's liquid depression. Never had another drop. And, you know, alcoholism was a theme with Elizabeth, Richard, theater in general. So those kind of aspects, people can walk away saying, oh, yeah, she has those demons, but she seems to be doing okay.
Yeah. Well, you are someone who has learned to persevere and also make your own success and be happy with the terms of that. And that's important. Yeah. That's important in this business.
Because the moment my dad called me, November 30th, 1977, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and said, Anne, I don't know how to tell you this. Your mother was killed in a car crash. The first thought was, okay, I'm taking over her role, so no grad school. So what did I do in 2018? I created my own self-study grad school. Never too late.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, we are just about out of time, but I do have one last very, very critical, important question for you.
Okay.
So throughout the show, you mentioned National Velvet many times, but do you yourself have a favorite Elizabeth Taylor movie? Is it National Velvet or is there another Elizabeth Taylor movie that you would like to say is your favorite?
Interesting, because in the show, and I, you know, I admit that I have never watched National Velvet to this moment right now.
Yes.
Because I'm going to cry. I'm afraid to see what I could have become if I had believed in myself at that age. Because as a young girl, I think I could have, my mother would say, you know, don't pick your nose. It'll make your nostrils big and you'll never be a movie star. Or she wanted me to be a movie star. But I was chubby. I went through a chubby phase. Then I was anorexic. I had no self-confidence, self-esteem. And I just think that I would fall apart if I watched National Velvet to see what everybody compared me to my whole life that I never lived up to. And so that is the truth about National Velvet, because it's very painful. I'm crying now. But some of my other favorite movies of hers, believe it or not, I love The Sandpiper for many reasons. It was filmed in Big Sur, and Michael Richards and I used to go to Big Sur all the time. And I love Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Elizabeth told me all kinds of backstage stories about that. I love A Place in the Sun, Giant, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Oh my gosh. Those are the ones that pop out in my brain.
Right.
One of these days, maybe I'll I'm going to be doing the Barrymore Film Center and they want to screen National Velvet the day before.
Oh, dear.
And I said, well, I'll have to think about whether I'm going to watch it or not.
Well, you know, if you're going to see it, seeing it on a big screen like that is a rare opportunity. You certainly don't get to see it on a big screen very often.
Oof,
you know, but or you don't and you talk about it the next night in your show.
I don't think I'm ready.
Yeah. And you'd be honest about it because it's revealing about your, it's revealing about yourself, you know, and it brings the audience in.
Yeah. I just didn't believe in myself. And Elizabeth could tell.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure she saw a lot of her younger self in you when she met you. You know, she remembers how old she was when she started in the business. And she remembers what it was like to be so young and so immature dealing with this kind of dealing with that kind of stuff. So
the character I played in Little Foxes is 13.
Right. And you were how old?
When I got the job, I was 22.
Yeah. I know. Time flies. Time flies. Anyway, Anne, it's been a pleasure having you here. But if you want to see Anne and you want to see her doing Elizabeth Taylor, The Shadow of Her Smile, it's coming up in just a couple weeks at the Arts Club of Washington in Washington, D.C. on February 28th, which is celebrating Elizabeth Taylor's 94th birthday, which is going to be cool. So there is going to be a link here on the website for you to get tickets for that event. And there's also going to be a link for Anne's website so you can keep track of what she's up to. And we look forward to getting this into book form so we can, which I assume will be much more fleshed out with a lot more stories and a lot more interesting things to talk about. But Anne, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Much continued success.
Thank you. You too. Thank you.